I never got to see Anaconda. So if we're going to turn to it for a point of comparison, I'm going to need you to lead that part of the discussion.
I'm not going to turn to it for a point of comparison.
Welcome to VoiceOver, Movies That Move Us. I'm your host, Heather Bigley, and I talk to people about the movies that made a mark, that led to cinematic epiphanies. And it's not always the movie you'd expect. Today, our movie is a movie you'd expect. It's Hamnet from 2025. Chloe Zhao adapted the screenplay from the Maggie O'Farrell novel and directed the film, which stars Jesse Buckley as Agnes, a woman of the woods who falls in love with local Latin tutor Will Shakespeare. The two marry, and then eventually Agnes orchestrates Will's relocation to London because she recognizes that he needs something that their small town life can't offer. When their son dies, though, the couple is in for a reckoning. Who loved most? Who's grieving most? My guest today is Liberty Barnes. She's a friend of the show. She's already talked to me about the movies Les Innocents and How Do You Know? She's a sociologist, an author, and general wise woman. And I'm glad to have her back. Stick around after the convo for more movie recommendations.
So in the very beginning, when she meets Will, he is having a hard time expressing himself. And he says, I'm not good with words. And she says,
tell me a story then.
A story?
Yes.
What story would you like?
Something that moves you.
Do you know the story of Orpheus and Eurydice?
The same thing kind of plays out when she is giving birth. She's suffering and she's dying, and her mother-in-law starts telling her stories.
Agnes, your husband was born here in this room. He took his first breath there by the window.
And I'm realizing, like, this is where they're setting us up, that, like, storytelling is how we communicate when we don't know what to say. It wouldn't have helped for her mother-in-law to say, you're going to be fine, just push through it, stay calm. Like, there really weren't words. And so she just starts telling stories. And Agnes always responds to a story, like, oh, okay, a story. I can do this, you know? And then she makes it through the labor and delivery.
Well, and we hear the story later. I mean, well, it's not even a fully developed story, but we hear the information later that the mother-in-law has actually lost several children. She's lost them to the plague. And what does that mean? And how do you deal with that kind of tragedy in your life? I think it's just interesting how their relationship develops in the film, because it moves from one of antagonism to they're in sympathy with each other.
To me, the mother-in-law represented Christianity and was supposed to stand in this contrast to the daughter of the forest witch, right? And to Agnes. Because when Judith is born, Judith, they think she's dead. And Agnes is like,
give me my child! Agnes, you have a baby boy. Let me bring him to you. You may feed him. The girl has gone to heaven.
She's not gone to heaven. I made a vow the night my mother died. I will go to your church, but I shan't say a word.
And then Judith lives, the baby lives. That became a thread throughout the film, was that the mother-in-law was always this representation of this sort of medieval Christianity where, you know, she's very stoic. I thought I'm sympathetic, but still pretty stoic when she talks about her daughters who had died of the plague.
Yeah.
And that was a really sharp contrast to when Hamnet dies and Agnes lets out that horrible, like, from the gut, you know, wail. Which was so in contrast to the mother-in-law, who was like, yes, we've had daughters die, you know, very sort of unemotional about it. And then there's this woman who says, I'm going to let myself scream, like from the depths of my soul, I am going to shout.
And we saw that also during the birth scene of the twins. There's that moment when they're trying to silence her.
Agnes, hush now. Hush, hush, hush.
Bear down, bear down.
She's just like, no, this is traumatic and painful, and I am going to scream. And you can't silence this experience for me, right? Which is, of course, from what we understand, part of why she would have wanted to go into the woods and give birth, which is what she did with the first child, is because in the woods, she felt comfort from this tree that becomes a representation of her mother. I don't know how well that comes out in the movie, but she would have had this comfort, but she would also have the space and she would have the freedom to express herself, and she wouldn't have to worry about upsetting anyone with how much pain she's in.
I can't help but look through this through the lens of the research I've been doing for the last few years. So I've written this book on the Children's Hospital, and there was a lot of discussion in interviews. I even had one doctor who talked about the fact that historically lots of babies died and parents didn't care. This idea has been written about a lot in academic research, is that historically most children didn't survive to age 5. They definitely didn't survive to adulthood. And parents just got used to that, that it would be pretty normal for someone to have 6 kids and only 3 of them live to adulthood.
That can't be true.
That cannot be true. There's a woman named Hannah Newton, who's a historian in the UK. And maybe 5 or 10 years ago, she came out with a book where she had gone through diaries and letters, I think from the 18th century in the UK, and like showing how desperate these parents were for their children to survive, that grief was real, that they did not want to say goodbye to their children. When I saw that scene, it reminded me, I did an ethnography in the children's hospital, and I remember there was this little girl who had died of a freak accident. And when the paramedics got to her, they brought her into the pediatric intensive care unit, and she was hooked up to all kinds of machines that were keeping her alive. And she was there for maybe 3 or 4 days. And the doctors were basically waiting for the parents to recognize that the girl was not going to survive and to make that hard decision to take her off the life support. The parents said, okay, tomorrow morning, we're going to do this. And it was really just to witness that firsthand was like the saddest thing in the world. They had arranged for all the grandparents and everyone to come and say goodbye the night before. And then the next day they were scheduled. When you take a child or an adult off of life support, they don't usually die immediately. They're going to live for a little while and eventually pass. When that little girl passed, the mother wailed. I mean, just screamed and wailed. Her voice was just ringing through the whole PICU and everyone could hear it. And I mean, it was just breaking every single heart. And when I saw that scene, like that's the sound, like that's what it reminded me of, was that like real life experience that I had had. A lot of the nurses I remember were like, whoa, like that's kind of unusual to have someone shout like that. But also, no one was going to stop her. Like, this is her prerogative. She needs to do this. This is her process. I just thought about, okay, so I had that experience. And then the other experience was I shadowed the chaplain in the children's hospital for a long time. And the chaplain was like, I hate these kind of conversations where people don't let themselves grieve the way they need to grieve, where they just try to end the conversation, where they say, well, I guess that's what God wanted, or this is how it was supposed to happen, or it was meant to be. And just to like think about those two things in comparison, where you've got the, well, it was meant to be, kind of this Christian mother-in-law in the movie. And then you've got the woman who just wept when her daughter died, and Agnes, who are saying, we do not live our lives according to platitudes. Even if our child went to heaven, and even if we're going to see them again, we are still allowed to scream. We're still allowed to be really upset right now.
I mean, what's interesting to me is that representation of Christianity is a very specific kind of Christianity, right? I wouldn't call it the Christianity that I myself believe in, that we're not allowed to have emotion, that we're not allowed to break. The Christianity that I espouse says we're all going to break. And because of all that pain, it's not that we shouldn't feel it. It's just that we should know where to turn eventually so that we can be healed again. And in fact, we make the healing less powerful or less effective if we can't even admit that we're broken.
I think this is what the chaplain was saying to me, is he was saying, this is becoming complicated grief for people. It's actually becoming more traumatic. And he was saying, we need a kind of Christianity that's allowing people to talk about how they feel and not, he would say, I don't like these conversation stoppers. I'm trying to keep these conversations open so people can really feel how they need to feel. I'm not even sure what kind of religion Agnes represents exactly. I watched it twice. I saw it once in the theater and then I saw it at home. And I think the first time I saw it, I thought, okay, so she's supposed to be some kind of daughter of a forest witch, probably a witch in her own right, and, you know, maybe has some magic, you know, it's like, okay, whatever. And then the second time I watched it, you know, she has her own faith crises. I think that after Hamnet dies, those times when we see Hamnet sort of in a dark and sort of, you know, it's almost like a cloudy sort of space, I kind of think that's Agnes's imagining of where he is. Where she's saying, like, I don't know where he is. Like, this is all building up to the last scene. Like, we don't know where he is. I don't know where he is. And gosh, it's so moving for me. Like, there's a lot of comfort in believing your child is happy and that they're in heaven and they're happy. And it's really scary to think, what if they're lonely? What if there's some place where they're just a kid and they don't have a parent and they don't have a friend? And even if they went to heaven, if they don't have me, how happy are they? <You know? laughs>
She said earlier to Will, she has that moment where she holds his hand and says,
I saw a landscape.
I saw a landscape?
Mm-hmm. Spaces, caves, clifftops, tunnels and oceans. This deep, dark, black void. Undiscovered countries.
I was thinking of that when I was watching those scenes. Like, potentially, she doesn't recognize his grief until the end, but potentially these are all the places of his grief, and her son is somehow lost in those places, kind of wandering. What's beautiful about the relationship between Agnes and Will is that it allows him to have all that love and affection that he never got. And he like really blossoms, and she allows him this space, provides for him this space where he becomes like a fully mature person. And then she says to him, it's time for you to go to London. You need to leave.
When she tells her brother, Bartholomew,
he needs to go to London.
London?
Yeah.
Why London?
Because London is where the whole world gathers. Perhaps he could extend his father's business there. He knows where he may be.
Again?
I'm not being hasty. He needs more.
But he needs proper work.
World.
A man needs proper work. He cannot just run
town,
away.
This little life, this little thing, you crush him. He needs distance from his father.
And you would go with him to London?
No, I'll wait until he's settled. There'll be more of us soon.
Another child?
Yes. By summer's end.
Now is not the time to send him away.
I'll lose him. I'm already losing him.
You'll lose him if you send him away.
No, I know that our love will keep us steady. Please, will you speak to his father? He'll listen to you if you suggest him going to London. Please.
Right, like there's this contradiction there. Like the only way I can keep him is if I send him away. I thought that was actually just a really beautiful understanding of human relationships, where you have to be able to see the other person's needs in order for the relationship to survive. And, you know, a lot of us want to just grab onto a relationship and hold it really tightly. And she says, he needs more space. He needs to be able to create the things that he's destined to create. He needs to be able to be around other people, think differently. You know, he needs all of this kind of growth in order for our relationship to survive. I mean, it's not just like he needs a certain kind of experience. It's like, you cannot have healthy relationships when people are unable to be self-actualized. If people are feeling like they're in a chokehold,
yeah,
they lose their ability to love and care for each other.
Of course, the death of the child is going to break that into pieces and they'll have to renegotiate what that looks like.
There's going to be trade-offs where one person gets to go to London and then later maybe another person gets to go to London and...
Right.
And those are really hard to navigate. And also, I mean, she does become resentful. Like, over time, she starts to realize, like, this is really hard with you away all the time. And he says, well, why don't you come to London? And she's like, I don't want to. And
right.
Which is actually setting us up for the end of the film. Like, this conflict between them of not only are they apart, but also they've lost their son and they're both grieving. Anya's has this question of like, I'm hurting, are you even hurting? I'm grieving, are you even grieving? And then he comes, you know, he follows her out of the room and he's like, I'm grieving. And she really tests it. Like, are you though? Because I would have given my life for that kid. And I was there and you were not there. Which is the setup for the end of the film.
For the end of the film, which is incredibly powerful. And I want to talk about it, but I do want to get... Well, the brother says that thing about keep your heart open at the end.
At the very beginning, she asks Bartholomew to give her permission to marry Will. And Bartholomew is like, this guy has nothing going for him. I don't know if this is a great idea. The family doesn't want you. And she says,
what would our mother say to us if we were afraid or uncertain?
To live with our hearts open.
Shut it not in the dark.
But to turn it to the sun.
And so then he comes back and reminds her at the end.
What shall I do?
Keep your heart open.
Obviously has so much more weight after the loss of the son, because all one wants to do in the face of that kind of pain is just mm-hmm. protect oneself. And here they're going to, you know, do this 2 or 3 day trip. Will doesn't know they're coming. They're just going to show up. In some ways, it feels like she wants to trap him and see what's going on in London. And then here comes this reminder from the brother to keep her heart open. That's where my tears started, because I couldn't imagine being in that much pain and being reminded that I had to stay vulnerable, even though everything was so painful already. I just think this character, as inhabited by Jesse Buckley, is fantastic. How wonderful to see this character on screen. She has confidence to live her life in a way that is true to her and is making, as you said, magic for the people around her. Like, how wonderful is that?
Well, and at the beginning, she says something to Will.
The women in my family see things that others don't.
You know, what's funny is for me, that was really relatable. I was like, yeah, I can too. And then I thought, actually, probably most women can, you know, that most of us are prophetesses in our own right. And we feel things and we see things very deeply that connect us to the future and to nature and to the world around us. And we don't always have the confidence to say, this is what I see and this is why this matters. I love that she's this character who says, because I see it, it is important and it deserves attention. Let's just take a minute and talk about how Jesse Buckley is like the best actress in the world. Because when he's telling her that, like, I'm going to take my sword and I'm going to clash it against the other sword. Like, I was shocked. And she's just watching him and she's like, yeah, yeah. Like, you can tell she just adores him so much. It was just so fabulous.
I mean, I think that's one of the things we're supposed to see in those scenes is the idea that this child is going to die just should blow our minds, because he's so healthy and vital and alive and funny. And of course, they're setting all that up so that when he dies, we ourselves are devastated by it. Like, this shouldn't happen. I didn't expect to be moved by the ending. I'd read the book and I was like, yeah, she's going to go see Hamlet. Long, long ago, someone once said to me in some English class, oh, Will Shakespeare wrote this play and we think it's connected to the death of his son. And I remember thinking, what a weird play.
Yes, it is weird, isn't it? The whole time I'm watching it going, what is going to happen in the play that I'm, yeah.
So the thing that moved me about this was, one, she's never seen a play before. And she comes into this space angry. What is her husband doing? There's that moment where they come out, you know, the first person comes out and is doing this prologue to the play. And she like screams at him.
Don't you dare pronounce my son's name!
Spirit. She gets so angry. I thought she was angry that Will had exploited their grief for fame. That yeah. he was taking her biggest heartbreak and saying, I can make money off this, or I can get famous with this. And that just made me angry too. That was a big point for me. A big emotional turning point too.
And then I started like, you know, I've taught Hamlet. So I've started running through the play. Like, what are the moments that are going to make sense that she would feel connected to her son? That this would in any way assuage her grief. And then I started thinking, well, maybe it's not about that at all. It very much is about her realizing that her husband has been grieving and that this is the way that he shows his grief, is that he makes his son alive, right, on stage. One of the things that the film does that is subtle but nice, I think, is that the actor who plays Hamlet on stage is the older brother of the boy who plays Hamnet in the family. So you can see this slight resemblance between the two actors.
And it actually helps to fulfill her prophecy.
What do you see?
I see you grown and very strong. And I see you in London working with your father.
In the theatre?
At the Playhouse.
Like, I imagine that she starts to realize that when she saw the future for her son, this is who she was seeing, was this actor who could stand in the place. At the very beginning, some of the foreshadowing that's happening through the film, the very beginning, he says, I'm not good with words. And she says, then tell me a story. So he tells a story. And so it's when she's in the theater that, I don't know if she realizes, but somehow understands that, like, he's telling a story now because he doesn't have the words. And what has been so frustrating in her marriage, that he doesn't have the words to express how he feels, to express his grief, he's now telling a story. And it's actually just so sweet when, as she's watching the play, she turns to her brother and says, he's traded places with him. And like, she realizes that the whole time she thought she would have traded places with Hamnet and died for him, she realizes that her husband would have done the same thing, that he's created this father ghost who takes on the death so that the son, you know, at least in that part of the story, lives for a while.
That's what he's able to do for her, is show her, I will switch places with him.
And then if you weren't totally losing it already, Will Shakespeare goes backstage and sobs. And you realize he is totally broken. And I think that was really heartrending. That's why you keep crying through till the end of the movie.
The other thing for me is I had this realization And again, it had to do with the audience. They're still not the sophisticated viewers that we are, where we can sort of create space between ourselves and the story. They are so fully immersed in the story, and they're like cheering and they're booing. And then that last moment when they all reach out to touch the actor.
The rest is silence.
I just had this realization of, we are built to feel together.
You know, she's the instigator, right? She's the one who reaches out first. And I started crying. And then I thought, I can't believe I'm falling for this. This is very cheesy. This is very manipulative. And then I look over and my husband's crying and the people in front of us in the theater are crying. And I'm like, no, this is happening. Like, this is really happening right now. And then the woman next to her reaches her arm out, and then slowly all the arms are coming out. It didn't feel like make-believe for that audience. It felt like this is really happening right now. They are really having a sword fight and someone might die, you know?
I was glad I got to discuss this movie with Liberty, and congratulations to her on her new book with Oxford University Press. And we agree, Hamlet is a weird play to write in connection to the death of your 10-year-old. Here's a play about a passive narcissist who is immobilized by fear and then drives his girlfriend to suicide and then ultimately is responsible for the death of like 10 people, including his own mother. Remind me, Will, what does this have to do with your kid? But you should watch Hamlet, you know, one, to see what I'm talking about, or two, because it is generally recognized as the artistic achievement of Western civilization. So there's that. But which Hamlet should you watch? Well, let's talk about it, because there's tons of options. If you want supernal acting and don't mind that the man playing Hamlet, who is supposed to be in college, is in his 40s, well, you should watch Laurence Olivier's Hamlet from 1948. It's going to be the standard by which all other filmic Hamlets are judged. It's beautifully staged, black and white. There's fog. There's a lot of theatricality, right? Which for some people isn't bad. But for me, it feels more like a stage play than a cinematic experience. If you want young people in your Hamlet, then Ethan Hawke's Hamlet 2000 is the obvious choice. It's set in a modern New York setting with the full fashions of the late 1990s on display via Julia Stiles' Ophelia. And, you know, is the acting great? Does the Shakespearean language sparkle? But it feels like a risk. And that is always welcome in a play about a young person. If you want to lose yourself in the set design and don't mind a couple of bathroom breaks, then Kenneth Branagh's 1996 Hamlet is a really solid choice for you. The entire unabridged play is filmed here, and no one's ever done that before, and no one has done it since. The set design and the costumes are gorgeous, and again, Branagh is using a lot of theatricality and some cool camera tricks, so it feels a little more cinematic than the Olivier. And if you don't like any of those options, just wait. There's a recent Hamlet that just premiered in the UK starring Riz Ahmed as a Hamlet from a British Indian family, and it looks very cool. If we're arguing that filmic Hamlets should actually look like their movies, this is going to do the trick. It'll be here in the spring. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Heather Bigley, your host. VoiceOver is a production of BYU Radio and is edited by Spencer Boyer.